I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hi everyone, welcome to episode 190 of the Intercooler Podcast with me, Dan Prusser, and my co-host, Andrew Frankel. This week we're talking about cars with fatal flaws, cars that might have been great were it not for just one or two minor things that frankly ruined them. We talk supercars, sports cars, little family cars, hatchbacks, all sorts, new stuff, old stuff. There's some real variety in there. Before we get started though, this Christmas, why not gift the petrolhead in your life a subscription to the Intercooler? You can choose from 6, 12 and 24 month gift subscriptions. They start at just £35.99. You'll be able to download a digital gift voucher immediately, and it's really easy to do. Just head to the-intercooler.com and find the gifts page. I'll also put a link in the description of this podcast. And we think it's a great gift. The petrolhead in your life would surely love a subscription to the Intercooler. So thank you for doing that. And let's get on with this week's episode. I think with this topic, it's almost inevitable that we're going to wind some people up, aren't we?
Well, I was about to say, I hope so. I only hope so insofar as if no one gets at all wound up by this, then it's probably not a terribly interesting podcast.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, I don't think we're setting out to upset people, but you're right. This is one of those topics, it's only interesting if we have fairly robust opinions, isn't it? So I think that's what we're going to try and do. I've got a list of cars here. I'm sure you've got a list of cars as well.
Yeah, no, can we sort of establish the ground? Because this isn't cars that are cars we don't like very much.
No,
it's not like and it's not entire. I mean, we talk about cars with fatal flaws. We're not saying, well, all SUVs because they're heavy, or all electric cars because they don't have much range. It's cars with specific failings.
Yeah,
and I'm hoping that many or most of them will be cars that, you know, so of course, a lot of them we might quite like, despite the fact that they've got, you know, they've been hobbled by a characteristic of some description. Which really lets them down.
Yeah, it's cars that might actually be great were it not for one, maybe two things that
could have been
get
great
in the way.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to get us started, and I feel sorry for this car, this particular car, because every time this topic or a sort of adjacent topic comes up, this car is nominated. It happens all the time, but I'm going to nominate it anyway. It is the Alfa Romeo 4C. I know there are lots of people out there who like theirs. They have them and they love them. Fine, that's great. But I view that car as a massive missed opportunity. It could have been fantastic because there's so much right about it. Carbon tub. A carbon fibre tub in a, what was it, 50-something grand car when it was new? Maybe a little bit more?
Really light. Yeah.
Yeah, really light. It doesn't exactly have a silken cultured engine. It's a 1.8 turbo 4, but it's a really boosty engine, and in a light car, it feels rapid, really rapid.
Yeah.
Love the looks, baby Ferrari styling. I like the Spartan interior. I mean, the thing looks fantastic on the move.
You know, I came very close to buying one.
Did you?
Yeah. When I can't remember how long ago it was, but when they first showed it at the motor show, I was so completely knocked out by it.
Yeah.
That I spoke to someone I knew on the stand and said, I really want one of these. I'm not committing to it now, but it was absolutely my intention. And then I was on another stand. I think I was on the Ford stand speaking to, you know, the mate of mine who works there. And he said, I hear you're buying a 4C. The amount of time it had taken me to walk from Alfa Romeo to Ford, the news had got out. And I just thought, well, you know, these things are not for, particularly when decisions haven't been made, are not for public consumption. And I didn't appreciate, you know, someone going, oh, Frank, buying a 4C. So I just thought, well, sod 'em. And I didn't. And then I drove it and was glad I hadn't.
Oh, gosh, I bet you were. Yeah, I bet you are. God, I hadn't heard that story before. That is amazing that rumour would spread like that, like a virus. Yeah. It's not good enough, is it?
No, so, not really.
The issue then with the 4C, and it's the handling, really, or probably the steering, more specifically. And it might even be particular to the UK's bumpy roads.
No, it wasn't, because I drove it in Italy.
Yeah.
I went on the launch. It wouldn't go in a straight line in Italy.
That's the issue, isn't it? It doesn't steer. And I've driven a few of them, and they were all the same. And we had later cars sent to us with a promise that it had been fixed. Here you go. This one's going to be much better. And maybe a minor improvement. But the trouble is, the thing would just meander and tramline across the width of the road. It would just tug and pull all over the place. And so even when you're trying to put it into a corner and it's tugging and pulling across the road,
you never knew where you were with it.
You don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You didn't know what's going to happen. So it was.
There were some people who got cars in the UK for press drives, and they were all transported down, and were told that the reason the car didn't handle properly was the bloke who'd stuck it on the trailer tied down the ratchet straps too tightly and knocked out the geometry.
Mm.
I mean, goodness sake!
Come on.
I mean, the great sadness of this, and I've got. There's something in my head saying that we've mentioned this before, but hopefully it was a couple of years ago, so people won't remember. But I'm sure I've had a conversation with you, either on this podcast or not, where we've just said, if they'd just taken it to Lotus, given it to someone like Gavin Kershaw, and said, Gav, just drive it for a day, and tell us what you think. That car could have had such a different story behind it. Because he would have said, I'm sure, guys, you are joking. Can't set it up like this.
It's not ready. He would have done.
And I suspect because the problem was so obvious and so fundamental, I don't understand why they didn't see it. Or my fear is that they did and thought it wouldn't matter. But I suspect, okay, you might not have been able to get it to handle like an Elise without a great deal of, you know, nickel and diming and refining work. But I suspect someone like Gav Kershaw could have made it massively better in a very short period of time by just, you know, doing what he does.
So a little while ago, David Tuig wrote a story about the Alfa Romeo 4C, sharing his point of view on that car and why he thought it turned out the way he did. Now, for those who don't know, David Tuig, he's one of our contributors. He is an engineer, and he led the development team behind the Alpine A110. And that's significant because they benchmarked the Alfa Romeo 4C. He knows that car inside out more than you know, a typical journalist will, because he's pored over it, he's weighed it, he's measured everything, he's taken the 4C apart, all sorts. And so his is a very informed view. And in this story that he wrote for us, it's available still on the Intercooler app and website. It's called Bum Steer, if you want to go and find it. I will put a link in the description as well. And it's very insightful. But I just wanted to pick out this one paragraph, which perhaps reveals why the car turned out the way it did. Now, again, this is just his opinion. He doesn't know for certain, but it's an educated opinion, isn't it? He said, I am convinced the engineers made an early decision to go unassisted with the steering. It doesn't have power steering, but were then unable to keep the vehicle mass under control. The giveaway is the front kingpin or steering axis inclination. It's close to zero, almost no caster angle at all. Caster angle
is why it doesn't go in a straight line.
Yeah. Caster angle is best understood by looking at the angle of a bicycle's headstock. If it's steep, like on a road racing bike, the steering tends to be flighty. If it's laid back, like that crazy chopper in the movie Easy Rider, it will be stable but lazy. That of the 4C is so unusually upright, you can actually see it with the naked eye. You don't need fancy geometry measuring equipment. So he thinks it comes down to caster. Now, as you say, if you've got no caster at all, you're going to have very low steering effort, but a very flighty, agitated feel on the road. Yeah. If you have lots and lots of caster, you've got very high steering effort, but massive stability in a straight line.
So yeah, and also great self-centering when you're coming off lock.
Yeah. Yeah.
And with power steering, it doesn't matter what the steering effort is.
Mm, exactly. So this car has no power steering, and the weight got away from it. So originally, it was going to be something like an 800 kilogram car. But this is David's theory. As the car sort of moved through its gestation, it got heavier and heavier. Perhaps there were budgetary issues, and heavier, cheaper materials had to be used here and there. Perhaps they ran out of time. Perhaps marketing got hold of it. Whatever happened, the car turned out heavier than it should have been. He's weighed them, and apparently they are much closer to 1,000 kilograms than 800. And so you've got maybe 10, 15, 20% more weight than imagined. Hence, the steering becomes outrageously heavy at low speeds, maneuvering. You need to get rid of the caster angle entirely just so that the steering effort is bearable in normal driving. And that's how you get that very flighty, hyperactive, agitated steering that means it's just all over the place on the road.
But it's so fundamental, isn't it? I mean, it strikes me as being a pretty extraordinary mistake to make. You know, they must have seen that coming. They must have known that, I mean, all things end up being heavier than, you know, their engineers would initially like them to be. And you know, what would a, I don't know, I mean, David would know much better than me, but I don't know what a power steering pump would have added to the weight of the car. Not much, but probably a few kilos.
So there was.
It would still have been a, by almost all other standards, a fantastically lightweight car. Even by A110 standards, it would have been a fantastically light car. And again, its story could have been, so they just made the wrong decision, didn't they?
They did. They did. And actually, there's a very interesting comment from one of our readers underneath that article. He said he had one. I had power steering retrofitted into mine, and it was genuinely transformational. That said, it was also £6,000. It's not a cheap upgrade. He said, I spent so much dough trying to get mine right. And it was about right, I guess, at the end of the day. But by then, I'd had enough of it, so off it went to auction.
Yeah, but okay, you can put power steering onto it. That's fine. But you can't change the gearing of the rack. You can't change the caster angle. You can't. The problem was not the fact that it didn't have power steering. The problem was that the car was too heavy for a car without power steering. So putting power steering on it is addressing one symptom, but all that's going to do is make your steering lighter. It won't, you know, unless you change the caster angle, it won't go in a straight line any better. You won't get any more self-centering out of it. So, you know.
It's a bit of a patch, isn't it? It's not a real solution.
Yeah, and it only solves one of a multitude of problems.
Anyway. That's right. Pity. So there's an interesting one. Yeah, but that is a great example of a car with a fatal flaw, because it could have been fantastic, that thing. It could have been fantastic. But some decisions were made, maybe at the beginning, maybe along the way, and it just didn't happen. Shame.
Can I do another two-seat sports car?
Go on.
Honda S2000.
Yeah. What was the
flaw? I mean, there are, you know, there's more than one problem with the S2000, but I'm just going to talk about the engine. And it just interests me because I'm a great believer in that principles are not indefinitely extendable.
Yeah.
And you and I know how great VTEC engines are. And how, certainly, you know, when I was younger than you are now, and Honda was putting out these amazing little hop hatchback engines with 100 horsepower per ton, which were revving to 8,000, and, you know, we were just having the best time in them. And this is their sort of Fonzie jumps the shark moment. This is when they just went too far with it. And so, yeah, this 2000 had a 2 liter engine with 237 horsepower, I think, which revved to 9,000+. And when it was doing that, it was unbelievable for the effort you had to go to get it up to those revs. And if you tried to put your foot down and you weren't absolutely in the sweet spot, which I can't remember what peak torque was, but it would have been at about 7,000 RPM, an engine speed at which most of its rival engines would have simply have given up and stopped working. It was just getting into its stride. Yeah, it was a racing car engine, but it wasn't in a racing car. And, you know, it's fundamentally, we got so excited about that car when it came out because we were just thinking, oh my goodness, this is going to be unbelievable. You know, a 2-seat front engine, rear drive, manual Honda with the most highly specified VTEC engine we'd yet seen, with a specific output which I think exceeded anything else in any other car that had been produced at that time. And he made McLaren F1 look quite understressed. And then we got in it and we suddenly realised that actually you can go too far with these things. And they did. And they spoiled.
And that's what you mean by a principle.
Yeah.
That's what you mean by the principle not being indefinitely extendable. It's not exactly that more revs or a higher specific output is always better.
Yeah.
There is a limit. Had the S2000 been 200 kilograms lighter, maybe that engine would have suited it a bit better. But that's an enormous amount of weight to take out of an already skinny car, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And I still think that a road car that doesn't come on a song until 7,000 revs, whatever it were, it's just, it's not suited to its environment. If you stuck that engine in a race car, you know, with some super, super short and tight ratio so that it was always boiling away, could have been mega. Could have been absolutely mega. But, yeah, it wasn't to be.
So I didn't have the S2000 on my list, but now that you mentioned it, it falls into another of my categories. And in that category, you do find the S2000, you find the Toyota GR Yaris, you find the Clio 172, the 182, the 197, the 200, the last Focus
RS. Where are you going with this?
The first turbocharged Civic Type R.
Yeah.
Seats that are set too high.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Definitely. I hate it.
Yeah.
It just annoys me.
Tell us what you really think, Dan.
Yeah, you sort of get used to it over, you know, the first hour or something. But you never feel as connected to the car as you would do if you could sit low. And when I get into a car, particularly a sporty car, and I crank the seat all the way down and it just keeps going and it just keeps going, I think, yes, here we go. Fantastic. Yeah. And when you don't get to do that, when you're up on stilts and you're constantly reaching for a lever thinking, it must go lower than this, it must do. Maybe you get used to it, but you still feel like you're up on stilts a little bit, like you're towering above the car. You're not properly in it and connected to it. And it does actually erode your confidence.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree. I just don't feel... I like to feel in a car, not on a car. And I like to feel surrounded by the car. I want to be as close to the road as possible because I think that's where the greatest sense of connection comes from. And it also makes me think, well, why are these cars like that? Well, with cars like the GR Yaris and the Clios, we know they're just hatchback designs and, you know, and being able to have a high driving position is quite important. But with cars like the S2000, you'd think there simply shouldn't be an excuse for it. And you wonder why they are that way. And, you know, why... Was it a choice or was it because there's something about the engineering of that car? Maybe there's some module taken over from something else, which meant it just had to be that way. Mm. But in any event, doesn't necessarily ruin... I mean, you know, one of the reasons why I like to be low in the car is I'm quite tall. You know, certainly if headroom is an issue, particularly with a car like an S2000 with the roof up, then obviously. But no, you're right. It's just... You want to be in the car, don't you?
You do. You really do. Can I just give you one more? I know I've done a couple there, but I just want to give you one more because it's it's kind of relevant if we're talking about the S2000 and sports cars like it with high revving engines. Mazda RX-8.
That's on my list. I love the RX-8.
Is the fatal flaw the engine, though?
Oh, completely.
Mm.
From an ownership proposition, yeah. A, because of the lack of torque, and B, because of the oil consumption and rototip wear.
Mm. So did you, but forget that, that stuff became an issue later on, didn't it? Do you remember when you first drove it? Did you think this engine makes this car better, middle or worse?
It's a really interesting question. I guess compared to what? Yeah. Compared to a 3 litre V6, like you would have gotten a, you know, a Z370 Nissan? Mm. Probably worse, but I did a couple of 24-hour races in them where they were always just fizzing away, and they were, you always had them up at $8,000. And they were mega. They were absolutely mega. But yes, in normal use, again, you're absolutely right. Just that lack of mid-range, get up and go. There are a few cars, aren't there, where, you know, they've got some, you know, terrific 0-60 time, but actually in reality it's meaningless, because a technically slower car with some mid-range torque would be gone by the time you found the right gear to get yours to take off properly. And it's that immediate usability that these cars lack. And yes, absolutely. But I've got a very, very soft spot for those RX-8s, because I think they're a very clever design. One of the most spacious 2+2s, and yet it looks like a two-seater. Amazing handling.
Yeah.
I mean, they handle, I can remember in those races, through the corners, you could sit on the back of, you know, fully race prep 911s with quite a lot of downswing. You just sit on their asses all the way through. And, you know, they were just such fun to drive. But, you know, again, you know, it's Mazda being sort of wedded to this principle of the rotary engine that was ultimately its undoing.
And then, so yeah, when they were new cars, I just thought they didn't feel fast at all. Even when you had them screaming, they never felt really brisk to me. But it's now that rotary engine has become a bigger problem, as you mentioned. They're a nightmare, aren't they? People, you have to get them rebuilt. And even then, they seem to be a bit of a ticking time bomb. They use a load of fuel. They just seem like, well, actually, to me, that rotary seems like more hassle than it's worth, much more.
Yeah.
Anyway, do you want to go?
Yeah, I'm going to do three. Okay?
Go on.
You got to tell me what that floor is. Tesla Model 3, Ineos Grenadier, Volvo EX30. They all have exactly the same floor.
Is it to do with the screens?
Yes.
Or displays or something?
Yes.
Everything in a touchscreen?
None of them put the information you need in front of you.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
None of them. The most basic stuff. How fast am I going? How much fuel have I got left, or range? You have to take, you know, your eyes have to come down and then across to the middle of the car before you can find that out. And it's just nuts. And I think it is symptomatic of, you know, of design departments starting to really crack the whip over their colleagues in engineering. But to the extent that, and what really annoys me about all these cars is the fix is so simple. Fine, have your big flash center screens with all the stuff on there and, you know, all that nonsense. Just give us a head-up display. It's a little projector buried in the dash, which you'll never see. And so we can just see how much fuel we've got and how fast we're going on a screen in front of us without having to... I mean, Volvo, you know, the most safest car manufacturer on earth, think it's absolutely fine to not look where you're going. And the other thing about the Volvo car, I'm going to go off on one now, is if you do take your eyes off the road to go and look at the screen, there's a little black box looking at your eyes. And then you get scolded. It flashes up a message saying, you've taken your eyes off the road, look where you're going. And the only reason you're doing it is because it won't let you see how fast you're going.
That's hilarious.
That is bonkers for Volvo.
Yeah.
It really, really annoys me. It's so basic. It's so indicative of design just starting to overwhelm simple, basic engineering due diligence. Just put the basics. It doesn't have to be everything. You don't have to know what your volts are or, you know, anything else. But the basic stuff that you need all the time, just put it where it can be seen.
While we're on this topic, actually, we need to talk about, there are so many cars that do this. And the sort of most heinous one is the new Range Rover and Range Rover Sport. They're about to lose their physical HVAC controls. They have them currently underneath the big central display, the big screen, but they're about to lose them into the screen, where inevitably they're much harder to find, particularly on the move.
Yeah.
And the only reason for doing it, well, presumably, as far as I can tell, is that it cleans up, visually, it cleans up that part of the car.
Brilliant.
As if that matters. Who cares?
Yeah.
Apart from some designers in Gaydon.
Yeah, but there is another reason. It's cheaper.
Cost, yeah.
You don't, yeah, I mean, buttons. I remember David Tuig saying that if you wanted to add a button to the dash of a car, it's about a three-year program. You can't just do it at a model year update. These things, because they are so difficult and time-consuming and expensive to homologate, how much better, how much cheaper just not to have them?
Yeah.
And make it and make it look like, oh, look, we've decided to go for this. I mean, the Volvo, the EX30, I think it's got two, might have three buttons, one for each window. Mm. It doesn't need those buttons. They don't even do the rear windows. That's what the third button is for. You press the third button, and then the buttons which had done the front windows now do the rear windows. Mm. Everything else, you know, if you want to, let's say you drive into a wall of fog on the M4. This is a Volvo, okay? You can't just go and switch your fog lights on. You've got to go into find and know exactly where to find them in whichever sub-menu on the center display, taking your eyes off the road while you're doing it, to put your fog lights on in your Volvo. I mean, how bonkers is that?
That is outrageous. All this stuff.
I really do think, I mean,
makes these cars
don't
worse.
Get me wrong, the EX30 is a, for, you know, a small electric car, I think it is, you know, in almost all other ways, it's absolutely outstanding. I wouldn't have one. There's no way in the world I would have one of those. Mm. And for that reason alone.
I'm out. Blimey.
Yeah.
It's so frustrating. It's so frustrating. It's like they've forgotten that we have to drive these cars.
Yes.
We don't just sit in them.
You just see people.
They're not autonomous yet.
Yeah.
Ah, good. This is fun. Hi, everyone. Dan here. Now, we'll get back to cars with fatal flaws in a moment. But first, I want to talk to you about VPNs. Many of us know what it's like to have our details or passwords stolen while we're online. VPNs, or virtual private networks, protect you from that. If you travel a lot with work and find yourself logging onto hotel or airport Wi-Fi networks, you could be at risk of this happening to you. We've partnered with NordVPN to offer our listeners 4 months free when you buy a 2-year plan. And you can get a fifth month free by using our exclusive link, nordvpn.com/intercooler. Or you can click the link in the description of this podcast. That's 5 extra months completely free. How many of us use the same password for everything, maybe with one or two subtle differences? Yeah, I know. That means we're playing with fire. But a VPN can protect us from hackers and scammers. NordVPN offers a 30-day money-back guarantee, so you can try it for yourself risk-free. Head to nordvpn.com/intercooler to get 5 months free of charge. That's nordvpn.com/intercooler, or click the link in the description. Right, let's get back to cars with fatal flaws. Another one. Porsche Cayman GT4.
Bloody hell.
Come on, you know what I'm talking about.
Okay, hang on. Porsche Cayman GT4. A fatal flaw in the Porsche Cayman GT4. You're talking about the current one?
I'm actually thinking about the previous one, but it does apply to the current one to some degree. Probably, maybe the same degree, actually. It's the only thing, the only way you can criticise those two cars. And fatal flaw might be pushing it, but you know what I mean.
I'm just trying to work out what you're talking about. Are you talking about the gear ratios? You're talking about the engine?
Yes. Gearing. So yeah. Long. Actually, it's ridiculous. The issue that I have with the gearing on those cars is that second will take you well beyond 60, probably well beyond 70, actually. And so on a UK B road, where the limit is 60 miles an hour, if you want to, if you get into second
Which
gear and you want to run the engine out.
Times.
Yeah, of course. If you want to run the engine out in second gear, you're busting the speed limit by quite a lot. And so it means that second is actually adequate for most. Or you get up to third, which will take you probably beyond 90 miles an hour. And so you're not using that. The gear shift is lovely. The clutch pedal weighting, lovely. But you're just not using them. It's so rare. And if you get up into fourth, you're suddenly well out of the engine sweet spot. It's massively frustrating. And whenever I have driven a Cayman GT4, I've been really annoyed by it.
Okay. It's interesting. So I do know exactly what you're talking about. And I think the original GT4 was actually far worse affected. And actually, although this is not an engine that I would usually speak up in defence of, one of the assets of the turbo four-cylinder engines that go into less Caymans and Boxsters is they have the torque to make better sense of the ratios to which they're attached.
Yeah, they do.
So the question is why? I mean, it's not as if Porsche didn't realise. And I can only imagine, like so many things in the car world today, that there was some emission standard, some fuel consumption figure that they simply had to get. And the only way they could do it was to put really long gears in it, because so much of these things are determined by the amount of fuel that the cars use at a certain speed, a certain amount, and the longer the gear, the less it'll use, the lower your CO2, and bang. I don't know. I can't think of any other reason, because it could be so easily fixed. You wouldn't have to go and design a new gearbox or anything. You just put a lower final drive in it. Just drop it all the way down. And then suddenly your problem goes away. But they haven't done that. And I'm sure, well, there must be a reason for it, isn't it? Because it's not as if they don't know. It's not as if, A, they didn't know, or B, they didn't listen to any other people who said this. So, I do know what you mean. Do you find the PDK ones easier or less annoying? Would you have a PDK rather than a manual?
It's such a good question. I actually don't think I would. I think for that kind of car, I would rather have a manual and put up with the ratios, but they would bother me. They would bother me all the time. And I have driven a Sharkworks Cayman GT4 with revised ratios, and they hadn't changed the final drive. They'd changed, I think it's third through to fifth or something, so not even all the ratios. And it was better, but the frustration, you know, second was still ridiculously long. So there's almost no gap between second and third. So it didn't quite fix the issue for me. But actually, do you know, it's interesting that you mentioned the four-cylinder turbo Cayman and Boxster, that engine, because that's on my list as well.
Yeah, well, I absolutely get that. I absolutely get that. It's not just a poor engine for a Porsche. I think it's just a poor engine.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can just tell. I mean, I know a little bit about the background of this engine because I once had a rather quite an honest conversation with the bloke who, or one of the blokes who engineered it. If Porsche were an independent company, were not part of Volkswagen, they would never have done that engine.
The pressure was on, was it?
The pressure was absolutely on them. And you can almost tell that it's an engine that wasn't done with any great love by Porsche. You can just tell. It's if ever there was an engine that Porsche did where they just thought, it's the sort of contractual obligation engine. Oh, well, we need to do this. We have to do this. We don't have a choice, but, you know. It's not without its disadvantages. You know, the torque, as I said, does make a bit more sense of those ratios. It also means that in the lower powered cars, the torque also enables you to exploit the chassis in a way that those low torque, naturally aspirated engines didn't. It just doesn't sound right, and it just doesn't feel right, does it?
Do you know what, though? I was looking at the classifieds, and you can now pick up a non-S model with it's a 300 horsepower engine, so a good amount of power. I think we're talking sort of 2016, 17. So still a modern car, modern comms. You can have one for 30 grand. And I'm beginning to wonder if at 30 grand, I could actually put up with the engine.
Yeah.
I think that would actually be quite a nice car. I don't like the engine, but...
Okay. If you had that car, do you think you just get used to it and forget about it and just, you know, it would just cease to matter? Or do you think it would just ever so slightly... Mm. compromise every journey you did in it? Every time you started up, you just think,
huh. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, but I'd like to try one again. Actually, I'd like to try one again. Go on, what else have you
can
got?
Can I do one?
Yeah,
another German sporting coupe.
Mm-hmm.
Audi TT.
Yeah,
the early ones.
Yeah. What was the fatal flaw?
I just find it surprising that a company like Audi could put a car into production which quite clearly wasn't stable.
Oh, really early ones?
Yeah.
Mm.
I just find it amazing. You know, there were, I mean, yeah, I don't want to, you know, say too much, but what we do know is that there were a sufficient number of incidents, some with very serious consequences. You know, I'm sure Addy would say that those incidents weren't down to them, they were down to external factors. But nevertheless, they re-engineered the car. They changed the suspension, they changed the ESP, and they put a wing on the bag. Now, would you do that just to return confidence, or would you do that because you actually realized that you had somehow put a car into production that wasn't stable? I mean, I have to say, as a kind of counter to that, you know, I drove those cars a lot and I drove them fast and I never had a particular problem with them. But maybe there were certain circumstances in which, yeah, and if you look at the shape of the car, I'm no aerodynamicist, but, you know, we all know what happens when air starts tumbling down the back of the car if it's not unchecked. It goes underneath the back of the car and it lifts it up, which is why all those fastback cars like 911s have all got wings on them.
Some sort of deployable spoiler, and later TTs had a little deployable wing to fix that issue.
And that's all you need. You don't need much at all. You just need to interrupt that airflow and stop it getting under the back of the car. It just needs to go elsewhere. You know, you're not using it really for downforce purposes. You're doing it to just cancel positive lift.
Yeah, it's a spoiler, isn't it? Literally.
Yeah,
it spoils that
airflow. Literally a spoiler. And maybe again, it was a design department. I mean, yeah, it was an amazing. How old were you when that came out? I think it came out, it was like 96. You'd have been 11, 12, 10. But I remember when it came out and it had that, you know, we couldn't believe that there was basically a Golf underneath all of that because it looked so amazing and the interior was so amazing and it was so close to the concept. And we just thought, wow. But it was, you know, it was a fantastic looking car, and that little wing on the back did actually spoil the look of the car. But goodness me, it was clearly perceived for whatever reasons, be they marketing or genuine stability, to be needed.
So, but you make, it's so interesting because the amount of testing that these manufacturers do, even 30 odd years ago, the amount of development work that they do is enormous. So. The chassis guys will have known that there was potentially an issue there, but maybe they just lost the fight. They lost that particular battle first time round because the design was everything to that car, and a little a little spoiler on the back did compromise it.
What I find so interesting though is it didn't kill the car. The Audi TT went, well, it's still in production. You know, if you look at something like the original Mercedes A-Class, you know, the infamous Elk test. Okay, so they fixed that really fast. You know, I brought my children up in the back of one of those. And they acted immediately, even though the car only flipped in the most unrealistic circumstances, you know, which was, you know, which were recreated on a runway in the most extreme driving scenarios imaginable. Mercedes acted. They fixed the problem, and yet that car was, I think, was fatally undermined by that event. Audi in North, you remember the unintended acceleration incident? Where an Audi, what I don't know what they called it over there, was it a 1000, but it's basically as an Audi 100 or an A6 or something like that, disappeared through a garage door. And all the, and the owner said the car just accelerated. I put my foot on the brake and it took off. And all the evidence was, actually, they just trod on the wrong bloody pedal or put it in the wrong gear or something.
Yeah.
That near enough killed Audi in North America.
Blimey.
And yet the TT, you know, goes walkabout and it's fine. People go, oh, right, it's, you know, it's fine. Maybe, never stopped them.
Maybe it looked good enough and people still wanted them.
Yes, and that's it, isn't it? You know, that Audi and that Mercedes were not inherently sufficiently desirable in their own right to save their own bacon. Whereas the Audi was, and people just thought, oh, I just really want one of those.
Yeah. I don't care if it spins me around on the motorway. Anyway, I'm going to give you one more, and you are not going to believe this, nor will you ever guess what fatal flaw I'm proposing on this car.
Let me at least try.
Oh no, you will not get it. It is the most pathetic, nitpicky complaint I'll ever make about a car. It's the Sports Series McLaren. So 570S, 600LT, 540C, the Spiders, all of them.
Okay. And what area are we looking at?
Cabin.
Cabin. Is it that little button you had to press to activate all the stuff?
Nope.
Because I really like that.
You're not going to get it.
Is it the fact that it's got really spidery numbers on the instrument? No, it's not that, is it? It's okay. Hang on, just bear with me. Is it the fact that it's an absolute bastard to get the nose lift to work because you've got to disappear into some silly submenu? They fixed that now. You just get a button.
That's not it. But that was atrocious.
Was absolutely atrocious. Is it the fact that the navigation system was an absolute farce on those cars? No, it's not that. Okay, hang on. God, I'm coming up with a few here, aren't
you? I didn't know you had so many reservations about this car.
Well, I mean, as I said, I'm just talking nitpicky. I absolutely adore those cars. I've been looking. You know, I was looking at prices of them the other day. In fact, I think I was looking at prices of them yesterday.
I've done the same
about
thing.
About 65 grand.
Yeah, I've done the same.
570 S. Actually, 570 GTs, which are actually I prefer.
Yeah.
570 GT about 65 grand. Oh, that's a. That's really tempting. Anyway, God, hang on. What is it? It's not visibility because you can see out of them beautifully.
There's no chance you're going to get it.
Okay. The sports seat. The sports seats in those cars were terrible.
You're sort
standard
of getting
seats
a bit
great.
Getting a little.
Oh
bit
no,
closer.
The electric seat buttons.
No.
No, because they were ridiculous. Okay,
right.
Okay.
I'm going to have to tell you. As I say, this is the most pathetic complaint I'll ever make about a car. It's the upswept design of the door card and therefore the angle of the armrest.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I've never a car. Only because I've never even thought of it once in my life.
I think I must be a man who likes an armrest. I'd use an armrest. But, I mean, right, so an armrest should be level. It should be as horizontal as possible because that's what you want to rest your arm on. This one, because there's such an upswept design to clear the carbon tub, actually, the armrest is at a horrible angle. So your arm doesn't sit on it. My arm didn't sit on it. I'd put my elbow down and my arm would just sort of gradually slide forward. I couldn't use it as an armrest. It basically meant to me that there wasn't an armrest on that side of the car. Middle of the car was fine. But on that side, nothing. And the trouble is, it just, particularly over longer journeys, it made me feel really uncomfortable in the car. Sort of not sitting square.
I would say I was as sensitive to that sort of thing as anyone.
Really?
I can remember I drove one of those to Spa. I drove one to Spa, had a very tiring time racing stuff while I was there. And then literally, I must have been there for like 2 or 3 days. And then I did the last race and got straight out of the race car, back into it, and drove it back to Wales. I absolutely loved it.
Mm.
Well, yeah, I mean, but certain things just set people off, don't they?
Mm. Yeah, but that's it. Everyone, we're all such unique sizes and shapes. And we all just sit in cars ever so slightly differently. And it can take the most minor thing.
Different things mean different things. So I get utterly infuriated if I get in a car and if the navigation is not set to north up. I only ever have navigation in north up. If it's not, if I can't just press an icon on the screen and get to north up and I've got to go looking for it, that bugs the hell out. If I can't turn the bloody voice off.
Oh.
If you can't turn lane keep assist off without a single press of a button, and you can do it. Some manufacturers go, oh no, you can't, we're not allowed to do it. You can, because if you have a single long press, you are allowed to do that. If you can't, what was I driving the other day? An electric Lexus, where you basically needed to be a particle physicist to work out how to turn everything off. All those sorts of things, anything which just gets in the way and willfully gets in the way. It's almost like they've tried and sat down and thought, well, how difficult can we make this? And it also makes you think that they've gone and designed these systems and they've never tested them. They've never gone out to people in the big wide world and said, go and live with this for 2 days and then come back and tell us what you think. Mm. Because if they had, they'd have pointed this stuff out.
Is this a rant?
Or maybe they did do all that and they thought, well, we don't care anyway. And if that's the case, why give it to them in the first place if you're not going to listen to what they say?
I think that is a rant. But I totally agree. And actually, it's a stretch to call these things fatal flaws, but they are important. So the M2 that I'm running at the moment, actually, like, I guess all or most brand new cars has an audible speed warning. So if you creep over the speed limit, you get it's bong.
And it
bong,
defaults to on, bong, doesn't it?
Defaults to on.
You know, I think that is now, that is my new least favourite phrase. Mm. It always used to be portion control. Now it's default to on.
Yeah, it's frustrating. Thankfully, on the M2, it's hold down the set button on the steering wheel for a couple of seconds and it goes away. So it's easily got rid of. But
if you stop for a pee or to fill it up with petrol, you go back to it. Yeah. It's back on again.
And the trouble is now, like I know which button it is. I almost do it without thinking. But every time I get in a new car now and it does it, I'm thinking, right, which button do I need to press? Because it's always different. I was in some Land Rovers the other day and they were doing it. And you have to sort of cycle, press this button, cycle through a couple of different options. Ugh, it is
annoying. So here's a question. Why, if you ask manufacturers why it's like this, they will say because the law requires it to be like this. Mm. And why does the law require it to default to on? Because it might not be you who gets in the car the next time. It might be somebody else and they need protecting. You might choose to not protect yourself, but the car tank can't take that decision on behalf of everybody else. So why not just have, you know, all our telephones recognize our faces. Even older telephones will recognize a thumbprint. Why can't you just put your thumb somewhere or just go, hello, it's me. And the car goes, oh, look, it's Dan. All right, well, we know what his settings are, so we'll do that. Because all Dan is going to do is put them back there manually anyway. Mm. So why not just spare him the bloody bother? Mm. God, I'm really going off on this morning, aren't I? I must have had a really bad weekend and not realised it.
We've got you riled, haven't we? This is fantastic. Well, you must have some more. Do you want to give us another one?
Yeah, it's a slightly weird one. The Maybach. So not the Maybachs they make today, but the car that came out 20 years ago to rival, you know, the Rolls-Royce Phantom.
Yeah.
Its fatal flaw was to call itself a Maybach, i.e. not a Mercedes. If Mercedes had just come out and said, we have done this super luxury long wheelbase S-Class, the world would have loved it because it was so good. It was so quiet and it was so comfortable. But because they thought, oh, bloody hell, you know, Rolls-Royce is coming back, we better stick another badge on it, even though it was just a long wheelbase Mercedes. And they, you know, they made, it was so token, the design efforts they made to make it look different. They just stuck a little bit on the front, but the rest was pretty much the same. And it just had no credibility at all, despite the fact that, I mean, I can remember being one of them, going down a motorway and realizing that the single largest source of noise in the cabin was the noise of the tires made by other cars that I was passing on the motorway.
Wow.
And just thinking, that is incredible. You've gone to all that effort.
Blimey.
And the ride was just ridiculously good.
Yeah.
Much better than a Phantom when it came out.
Wow.
And yet, because they'd gone, we're a Maybach and we're going to charge, you know, a bazillion quid for it, it just didn't work.
Do you think the name Maybach had any currency then?
None at all. Nobody knew what a Maybach was. Who could have heard? I barely remembered Wilhelm Maybach. You know, he last made a car before the Second World War. What's the point?
Yeah. That was weird. It almost speaks of a lack of confidence, that, doesn't it? Go on. Yeah, let's have another.
Jaguar X350. So this was the XJ that came out about 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Are you talking styling? Design?
Yeah. Well, I mean, a combination of the two. So this was the car that came out and it looked like it was the kind of car that, you know, an old boy would drive down to the golf club on the weekend while wearing a hat.
Mm.
And it was such a staid, boring-looking car, despite the fact that in engineering terms, it was a complete revolution.
Mm.
This was the first car of its kind, maybe the first kind ever to have an entirely aluminium monocoque. Mm. It was hundreds of kilos lighter than the car it replaced, despite being a much bigger car. And to me, they were amazing, those things.
Mm.
And to go and design a car which is so revolutionary, and I use the word advisedly, and yet make it look the absolute opposite of what it absolutely was, of what it was. Mm. And of course, we know what happened. Finally, Ian Callum, Ian did turn up just before it came out, but he didn't have nearly enough time to read. He literally had time to make a few tiny little changes because the design was sealed by his predecessor. And then, the car was completely reskinned by Ian into, I can't remember what his X number was, but we all know the car. It was the last XJ.
Mm.
Now that JLR and its infinite wisdom decided to can the next one.
Mm.
And it looked amazing. And finally, they had a car with the looks to, complement the engineering brilliance behind it. But yeah, just bizarre.
It was a shame, a real shame. Do you know, even when I see one, I have to have a decent look at it to figure out if it is the X, it's 350, isn't it? Or if it's the previous one. It's almost a facsimile of the older car.
Yeah, but it's not quite as nice because it's a lot being the previous car, which I thought was a great looking car. So this was the X308, I think, the first of the V8 XJs, which came out in the late 1990s. One of the problems with it, and one of the reasons it looked so good, frankly, was it had that very low roof line.
Mm.
But it also meant that headroom in the back was really limited. So they made the car larger, particularly taller, but kept the original design language, and it just didn't work.
Mm. Yeah. That's a good one. We are running out of time. Have you still got a massive list that we need to rattle through?
Well, I've got some old stuff.
Go on.
But actually, because of the way the podcast has progressed, so I got cars like the Alfa Sud because it rusted, the Ford Pinto because it blew up if you ran into the back of it.
Yeah.
Talk
about fatal flaws.
A word for the Arna. You won't remember the Arna. You weren't even alive when the Arna. Does the word Arna mean anything
Arna,
to you?
No.
Arna. Okay. So this is brilliant.
What's
this is
that?
Absolutely, completely brilliant, okay? So Alfa Romeo realised that it had a bit of a problem with, sort of build quality and that sort of thing. And Nissan at the same time thought we could do with a bit of glamour. So they did a JV, and the result was called, when it was badged in Alfa Romeo, it was called the Arna, which I guess was Alfa Romeo and Nissan. And when it was a Nissan, it was badged the Nissan Cherry Europe. Yeah. So what you'd do if you were being really clever is you would get Alfa Romeo to engineer it and put the suspension on it and do all the fun bits. Yes. And then you get Nissan to build it.
But
they did exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
It was completely and utterly ludicrous. Shout out for the Triumph Stag.
What was wrong with the Stag?
A beautiful car.
Yeah, cool looking thing.
And it was powered by a brand new 3-litre V8 engine. Mm. What could possibly go wrong? Well, that brand new 3-litre V8 engine.
Oh.
They were so unreliable.
Mm.
They were. It just completely killed the car. And in fact, I think an enormous number of Stags that survive today just have Rover V8s in them. Because that 3-litre engine was just, I think the cooling of it was poorly designed and then the whole thing was poorly put together. So you can put them back together. I think there have been fixes and maybe they're fine now, but at the time they were terrible. Lancia Beta Monte Carlo, another one of my favourite cars, didn't stop.
Really?
In the wet. They had big servo systems on the, and they just locked up the front tires. It was a mid-engine cars have always had a little bit of trouble with, because they've got very light front ends.
Yeah.
If you drive a 1970s 911 SC on the tire technology that was available at the time, you've got to be really careful with them in the wet.
Mm.
But the Beta Monte Carlo was absolutely awful. And they did sort of fix it. They took the servo off it and they changed this and that, and it was an awful lot better. But again, the car had been doomed by it. Mm. Hillman Inn. Amazing little car. Little rear engine, alloy blocked. Should have been very, very well reviewed when it first came out. Should have been an absolute world beater, but it was put together so badly. Mm. Again, it became terminally flawed. So yeah, I've got all sorts of stuff like that. It's not really where we ended up going with this podcast. And looking at our timer, I think we're out anyway.
We are, but nothing if not variety in that one. Supercars, modern cars, old stuff, little things, all with fatal flaws. Good. Topic suggestion came from a Twitter poll, I think, didn't it?
Indeed.
We put out a call asking for ideas for the podcast, and that was one of them. So thank you, everyone who suggested that idea. That was good fun. We've got a listener question coming up in a moment. But before we do that, as it's Christmas time, I'm just going to remind you that you can buy, for the petrolhead in your life this Christmas, a gift subscription to the Intercooler. You can choose from 6, 12 and 24 month gift subs. They start at $35.99. You can download a digital gift voucher immediately, which means if it's Christmas Eve and you still haven't bought the gift for this one person, the petrol head in your life, come along to the Intercooler and we'll make a digital gift voucher available to you immediately, which you can print at home or
even if it's Christmas Day and you're going to go see your uncle on Boxing Day and you realise you haven't got him anything.
Yeah.
We're here to help.
Go to the-intercooler.com, find the gifts page. It's really easy to do. And I'll also put a link in the description. So the listener question comes from Ross G. Simple one. What's the worst car you've ever owned?
I've tried really hard not to own bad cars.
You've done better than me then.
What's the worst car I've... It's terrible. I don't think I've owned any... My Lotus Esprit.
Ah, yeah, you have spoken about this before. Sounds like a massive letdown.
My 1981 black S3 with gold BBS wheels. I adored that, but not even I can forget it never completed a single journey of any meaningful length without going wrong.
Yeah, that's pretty terrible.
And it wasn't like, you know, so it was 1981 car. I think I had it in about 86. It was about a 60-year-old car. It had done 25,000 miles. There were absolutely no excuses. And it was appalling. Things would go, clutch save cylinders would go, you know, the headlight pop-up thing. So it used to wink at people. Completely random. You'd just be driving down the road. And there'd be a clump of people standing by a bus stop and it would just wink at them. Mm. It would just raise one and put it back down again. It had these twin choke Delorto carburettors. Keeping those in tune was an absolute bloody nightmare. Mm. It was just a terrible car, but goodness me, I loved it.
Good answer. Well, Ross, thank you for your question. And do keep your questions coming. Because they're fun. We like ending the podcast that way. You can send us a message on Twitter, on Instagram, or you can email us info@the-intercooler.com. But keep doing it, and we'll read out another one next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.